If SAG members can start taking their seats, we're ready to start the next session. Thank you.
Well, thanks, everyone, for being prompt in the relatively short break as we're trying to accomplish a lot today. Board Member Charlie Niemeyer will make some comments to introduce our next subject, which is a discussion of the FASB IASB projects and the potential impact on auditors. But before I turn it to Charlie, I'd like to welcome FASB Board Member Larry Smith and thank Larry for coming to join us for this presentation, as well as SAG members Jamie Miller and Mike Gallagher, who will participate in the panel and make comments from a preparer's and an auditor's point of view with respect to the change that's going on. Charlie, thank you.
Thanks, Marty. I don't think this needs much of a setup. Certainly, it's well understood that FASB and IASB have been working toward convergence for some time. For a number of reasons, a deadline of 2011 was established. Certainly, as time moved forward, the more difficult standards was taking longer, and there was a large amount that needed to be done a short amount of time in order to meet the 2011 deadline. But certainly dedicated to the convergence effort and bolstered by the G20, both FASB and IASB committed to redouble their efforts to meet those deadlines. And recently, some questions have been raised about the aggressiveness of that schedule and the reasonableness of being able to for companies to be able to absorb the speed by which those standards would be put into the system. We are very fortunate to have three people who are very knowledgeable to lead the discussion. We'll start with Larry.
Thanks, Charlie. About 2 months ago, Marty called me up and said, gee, I think we ought to have a discussion about the audit implications of the tsunami of accounting standards that's about to hit the world. And for some reason, I agreed to participate, so here I am. I would like to reemphasize some of the remarks that Marty made earlier, and that is, this is a discussion about the audit implications of the accounting standards, not about the accounting standards themselves. So those of you that packed your briefcases full of ripe tomatoes, should put them back. I need to give the typical disclaimer. These are my views, only my views. I probably don't need to give that disclaimer since fellow board member Tom Linsmeyer is here, and I'm sure Tom will not be reluctant to correct me when I say something that he doesn't agree with.
That never happens.
Yeah, right. I'm going to go through these slides. I'm going to assume that most of you have been through them already because the slides were prepared at about a 20,000-foot level. I'm going to talk to them at probably a 50,000-foot level because I don't have enough time to get through them, but I am going to focus on a couple of things. The first one is just in terms of, some people might question what is it that's driving the FASB in terms of setting its priorities. And we've had discussions about this internally for quite some time, and all board members agree, as well as our trustees have agreed and have said publicly, that the prioritization of our work should come as follows, and that is, first of all, to maintain independence over what our process is, over our due process. The second is that we should have in mind an improvement in financial reporting in the United States. And the third is to converge with IFRS. And those are the principles that we stand by in terms of directing our behavior. And I think, you all should be aware of that. I'm not going to go through this slide in detail other than a lot of people ask, gee, would your agenda be significantly different if you were not on the way to towards convergence, and I think most board members would agree that it would. Perhaps, you know, the degree of effort at any particular time might vary from board member to board member, but I think our agenda would look pretty similar to the agenda that we have right now. This thing isn't working. Okay. In terms of drivers of the timing, I think most of you understand, you know, the financial crisis has obviously influenced the speed with which we're addressing issues. G20 has asked for us and the ISB to redouble our efforts. Well, in fact, I would say that we've at least quadrupled our efforts. The SEC monitoring process in terms of they ultimately coming to a decision regarding adoption of IFRS in the U.S., they will be taking a look at the amount of progress that we've made collectively on the various MOU projects. The June 2011 date that many people have referred to is there for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is some of the countries that have announced plans to switch to IFRS in either 2011 or 2012, as well as the IASB's desire to have a stable platform for a number of years while people adopt. And there are a number of board members, original board members, that will be turning over, including the chairman, Sir David, in 2011. One of our major concerns has been really the ability of you all, the constituents that provide us input, which is essential to coming up with appropriate standards, your ability to digest everything that we put out. We've had a number of letters recently from the CFA, the FEI, ITEC, as well as firms, et cetera, that have said, look, it will be impossible for us to comment on these. We've had a number of large international companies tell us that while they typically respond to everything that we issue, they will not have time to respond to everything. So they've asked us to reconsider it, slow down, et cetera. And in June, the IASB and the FASB met, discussed this, and came up with a staggering of our projects in order to provide people with more time. Now, is that enough time for everybody? You know, we're not so sure. You know, we're aware of some recent communications that have indicated that, gee, you know, we appreciate what you did, but you didn't do enough, so how about doing some more in terms of slowing down and staggering? And, you know, we will do our best in order to try to comply with requests. But at the same time, you have to understand that when you're working with international organizations that are putting pressure on you to get things done by a particular point in time, there's a degree of negotiation that goes into what your final consideration of timing is. So we're working with that delicately, but I can tell you that from our standpoint, we will not come up with a final, and I think I speak for the entire board. If Tom wants to correct me, he can, but I don't think he will, that we will not issue a final standard on something if we don't think that we've adequately heard from constituents and considered constituent comments on proposed standards. I think we are very sensitive to what your views are, and we will consider them as best we can, but we will not issue a standard if we think that there has been inadequate due process. Again, I'll go back to that slide that I presented. You know, independent due process is at the top of our priority. You know, next is improvement in financial reporting for the U.S., and then finally convergence. So that's where our priorities are, and I think we will behave that way. In terms of the June 2nd statement, which was supplemented in detail later on in the month, the SEC specifically came out and said that this staggering of standards will not impact their ability to make a decision in 2011 about moving to IFRS. And that was a very major concern, particularly on the part of the IASB, when we started talking to them about staging our various projects. I'm not going to go into detail on this. There are a couple points I'd like to make. First of all, it says insurance summer 2010. That summer 2010 is definitely a target of the IASB. In terms of the FASB, we have yet to determine whether we're going to issue a document or in what form a document, if we do issue one, it will be. So don't take insurance to the bank yet. I put a question mark under early 2011 for financial instruments with characteristics of equity just because of a couple of factors. First of all, the project manager dealing with it is going to be going out on maternity leave fairly soon. And secondly, it's just a very complex area. We issued a what we call a fatal flaw draft to various people when we were thinking of issuing an exposure draft. Let's put it this way. That fatal flaw draft fell flat on its face. Okay, we got a significant number of very, very critical comments such that we decided not to issue the exposure draft. And, in fact, we're in the midst of trying to reconsider exactly how to approach this topic, whether we do it strategically through a what's called a surgical fix of what we have now in GAAP, which could be difficult and might not improve things dramatically, or whether we go back to the drawing board and start over again. So I wouldn't hang my hat on early 2011 for an exposure draft there. Caution about the timing. Probably the biggest point here is that while we've said we're going to issue no more than four major exposure drafts in any particular quarter, you know, historically we've never issued more than four in a year, and the IASB in its nine-year history has only issued nine major standards. So to say that we have a challenge in front of us is understating the case. The one point on this slide, it says that we don't agree on particular issues, and the second one where it says leases in terms of lessor accounting, that can now be eliminated because we, since preparing these slides, we have agreed on lessor accounting. But it will come up later on in terms of challenges for you all. I'll skip over this and now get into the details. Financial instruments, I think it's fairly obvious to all of us that financial instruments is probably one of the most important projects on our agenda, and this was just reiterated by the financial crisis. You know, obviously we have complexities and inconsistencies within U.S. GAAP as well as IFRS, you know, not the least of which is different impairment approaches just for different types of financial instruments as well as different impairment approaches between us and potentially what the IFRS, what the IASB is recommending. And finally, some people have advised us that we shouldn't say this, but I'll say it. Fair value to some of us is almost like a religious war out there, and we are trying to deal with that as best we can. What we've done is our exposure draft really proposes to maximize information to investors so that there's both those that are in the fair value camp have that information and can use it to the extent they want and need to. Those that don't agree or are not in the fair value camp have information relative to how a company runs its business, et cetera. So there's both fair value information as well as amortized cost information. I think we've issued our exposure draft. Those of you that follow the standard or the standard setting process know that it was a close vote in terms of what we exposed. It was a 3-2 vote. And in fact, we have both camps represented right now at this table. You know, I would not consider myself to be a fair value zealot, if you will. But yet I was going along with some of the decisions, because in standard setting you do compromises, okay, in order to come up with maximizing what you think to be information, improving information to investors. And I was going along just fine until we got to deposits. And we're not suggesting, or we're not proposing, that deposits be carried at fair value, but rather something close to fair value. It's a current value notion. And that's what kind of threw me over the edge. People have decided to go along with that for different reasons, but I think this proposed solution will be a challenge to you auditors, and we'll get into that in more detail. Probably the most important thing that isn't mentioned on this slide is that in terms of our simplified criteria for hedge accounting, we've simplified it to use a reasonably effective criteria, which is different than the high hurdle that you have now in order to reach hedge accounting, but that will obviously have some audit implications. We have major challenges to convergence in financial instruments because, as most of you know, the IASB implemented or approved IFRS number 9, which is very different from what we've proposed. They have an amortized cost bucket for a number of their financial instruments, and we are going to have challenges in front of us in terms of seeing if both boards can come together. I'll skip through these. Okay, fair value measurement, just to make you aware of the fact, there is a fair value proposal out there to change 107, or what was 107 now is topic 820, I think, if my memory serves me correctly. There are not very major changes, but when you look at our proposal, it's going to frighten you because there are changes all over the place. And that was primarily in order to conform the words of our standard to what the IASB is finalizing. But there aren't substantive changes in terms of a lot of those words. Probably the most substantive changes are that we've eliminated the highest and best use concept for financial instruments. We clarified that a blockage factor should only be used for level one measurements. We've put in an exception for fair value of financial instruments that are managed as a portfolio so that you can fair value them as a portfolio. From a practical standpoint, that's not a change because that's how financial institutions were doing it to begin with. And we've implemented sensitivity disclosures, which probably is one of the most major changes of that standard. Single statement of comprehensive income is just saying that you present your income statement, below it you put your changes in comprehensive income, and that all has to be together. You can no longer, let's say, hide your statement of changes in comprehensive income in the statement of equity, which is what most people, I say hide, but you can no longer present your statement of changes in stockholders' equity or comprehensive income in the statement of changes in stockholders' equity. We did this because it links to the decisions made in financial instruments, and because there are a number of board members that steadfastly believe that it's important that when press releases go out, that the press release include the changes in comprehensive income. So that was one of the primary driving factors. But it doesn't change anything in terms of the format. Other than, I take that back. No, it doesn't change anything into the format of that statement. Revenue recognition, we've been working on this for a number of years. We finally, in the last couple of years, have gotten some solid direction, and we've issued a proposed document that will establish a common principle for all industries, and it's really based upon a transfer of control of benefits and satisfaction of what your obligations are to customers. I think that some of the highlights in terms of changes is that credit risk is initially factored into the measurement of the revenue. Additionally, what's not on this slide is that contingent consideration or variable revenue is included in your consideration of revenue, and it's using some type of an expected value, a probability-based notion of what revenue is. Leases got onto the agenda primarily because of the A, the rules-based nature of our standards to begin with, and B, the SEC's report on off-balance sheet financing. We've been working on it. We've pretty much come up with a converged solution. Lessees will record a right of use asset that record an obligation associated with that for all leases. Lessors was a sticking point because there was one camp that felt that you should use a performance obligation approach, so you should record a liability for your obligation to allow somebody to use the leased asset over time. There are other people that thought you should de-recognize it. What we've done is we've married both views and said that they're both pertinent. You know, some people should put a performance obligation on those people that are renting, let's say, those people that are turning over assets and renting to multiple users, similar to operating leases today. Those people that are leasing something for long periods of time where most of the risks and rewards of ownership have transferred to the lessee, they get a partial derecognition approach for those assets. That will be a challenge to the auditing profession. Those decisions were made after I developed these slides. So, consolidations is a classic example of what happens when standard setters leapfrog one another. Okay, we issued a standard to address some of the concerns over 46R, et cetera. The IASB then, which was standard number 167, the IASB then took a look at consolidations as a whole to address both variable interest entities as well as voting interest entities, and they came up with an exposure draft on that. We, in turn, deliberated with them when they were in the process of re-deliberating the comments that they received, and, in fact, we probably came to a stalemate in terms of differences of views among our board members as well as theirs. And what we've decided to do is, let's say, hold back. We're going to issue their exposure draft or final document on consolidations. We're going to issue their exposure draft.
We're going to hold a roundtable.
Yeah, but we're going to make available their exposure draft and hold a roundtable to see whether people believe that we should change the model for voting interest entities. Okay, and the model, right now we have a 50.1% consolidation model. They have a, if you have the ability control model. Now, they have that in words in their standards, but yet people believe that internationally, from a practical standpoint, people look to our standard in terms of how they implement their standard. So we want to get views of people as to whether we should be changing our consolidation model as it pertains to voting interest entities. And we'll do that, I believe, in the fall. There are a number of other projects on our agenda that I haven't addressed here, not the least of which is insurance. Insurance, I can tell you, is a major project for them because they don't have a standard on insurance. We do. And our board members, I think as a whole right now, are not in sync with some of the decisions the IASB has made. So therefore, they're proceeding to draft an exposure draft. We have not decided what we're going to do yet. And I expect that in the next few weeks we will be deciding. Okay. Issues for auditors. I think generally I've tried to summarize some of the major issues in terms of principles versus rules-based, you know, revenue recognition. We're going to be eliminating over 200 pieces of literature out there, so I think there are some fundamental principles that, you know, you all will need to apply, and that's going to put some challenge to you. It's going to create some challenge to you. We have a number of documents where we've now indicated what the disclosure objectives are. And in the document, we say, look, here are the specific disclosures we think will accomplish these disclosure objectives. But by the way, if complying with those specific requirements don't accomplish the objectives, then you need to disclose something else. That, again, is going to put some create some challenge to you all. Consolidations, if we adopted where the IASB is, that would do away with the 50.1% evaluation of consolidation, and that's going to create some significant challenges to you. Lessor accounting, while we have a derecognition and a performance obligation approach, they're very different, and it's going to be judgmental as to how to evaluate whether somebody has retained significant risks and rewards associated with the leased asset or not. You know, right now, we have the 90% test and the 75% test in terms of doing that evaluation because, you know, current GAAP in my mind is trying to achieve the objective of what we've decided relative to this project, but we're taking away that 90 and 75% test because you all want principle-based standards. Well, now you got them. Let's see what you can do with them. Financial instruments, you know, how you account for something, whether you account for it as something held for cash flows, it's based upon your business model. There's no tainting involved in the standard, so that's going to be a challenge. The expanded use of fair value, I don't need to say anything about that. Core deposits and how to value those, that's going to be a challenge. The amortized cost exception, I didn't mention this, but if you have hold more than 50% of your assets in financial type instruments, then you need to account for your liabilities at fair value. If you have less of your assets at that are financial instruments or accounted for at fair value, we allow you to elect an amortized cost exception in order to not create a mismatch, if you will, in your measurement attributes. You know, that's going to be a challenge. There's no probable threshold for impairment anymore. That's going to be a challenge. Cash collections in excess of interest accrual, what the proposed standard requires is you book those cash collections as an increase in your allowance, but then it says reconsider whether your allowance is enough, too much, or what have you. And assessing reasonably effective under hedge effectiveness is going to be a challenge. Fair value, we're going to have sensitivity disclosures, and in those sensitivity disclosures, you need to consider the interrelationship of different variables. So that is going to be something that is not easily done. The netting of financial instruments based upon portfolio management of risk, that also is going to require a lot of judgment. RevRec, when to combine and separate contracts, determining what the transaction price is. The allocation of the transaction price to performance obligations shouldn't be that difficult. I think you're doing it already. At least you were supposed to under 081, so you should have some experience with that. Assessing the satisfaction of performance obligations will be a challenge, as well as assessing contingent consideration. Leases, in our proposed lease model, you have options to renew or cancel, but yet you need to consider the likelihood of whether those options will be elected in measuring your lease receivable and your obligation. So those will be judgmental areas. Contingent rents will be a challenge, although in the lease document there is a particular reliability threshold that you need to exceed before you consider contingent rents in your measurement of your leased assets and liabilities. Separating payments for services from lease payments is a major issue that is going to be a challenge. Consolidation, I think I already addressed. Insurance, I didn't even bother to list the challenges in insurance. You know, insurance accounting, at least what the ISB is proposing, is like I characterize it as let's account for the future today. Okay, that's what it is. And in terms of your revenue stream as well as your liability stream, And I said at a public meeting I would never audit an insurance company, you know, and if you do audit insurance companies, I hope you have a lot of insurance. financial statement presentation, the indirect direct cash flow method, will raise certain challenges to people. So I'm sure there are a number of other issues I didn't even think of, but with that, I'll stop and pass it on to my next expert.
Thank you, Larry. I think that's a really good foundation for Mike and I to provide some observations on how the process and later the implementation will affect both preparers and auditors. I do think this is a very timely topic. And, you know, before I start, I'd like to just applaud the positive steps taken by the FASB and the IASB to really prioritize and time phase the exposure documents now being released for comment. You know, and considering the actions already taken by the boards, we are still concerned, though, that the volume of major new standards, and you heard this from some of Larry's remarks, you know, is really unprecedented and continues to pose significant risks for companies and their auditors that should be carefully evaluated and proactively addressed, not just by the FASB and the IASB, but really by the regulators, both the PCAOB, the SEC, and others. You know, a lot of the changes that we're talking about here, and Larry talked about this, are really fundamental, and they affect many, if not all, industries out there. The volume's significant, and we worry that that may have an effect on the quality of the FASB and the IASB technical activities, the ability of preparers to adopt, and the ability of auditors to audit the required changes. And I take a step back, and, you know, we've always had a history at GE of being very, very active in evaluating standards that are proposed, that are new, and it's largely because we are diverse and we are big, and I have a fundamental belief, as do I think the company, that a preparer's ability to adopt is often highly correlated with their involvement in and their understanding of a standard as it's developed, and I think the same can be said of auditors. It's just really helpful to understand the conceptual framework and the basis for the board's decisions as you then apply it in practice. And so with respect to the proposals and the process going on, I guess I have four different observations. First, you know, the current volume is historically significant, and given that, I think it's really critical that the process continue to be thoughtful, involve appropriate comment and outreach periods, and that careful vetting takes place, and that we watch the signs to know when we ought to slow down further. Second, the proposals collectively represent, you know, very significant and fundamental changes in GAAP. They incorporate major shifts in RevRec, significantly increased use of fair value for financial instruments, and a new conceptual framework for leasing. I mean, Larry talked about all this, but those three in and of themselves are very, very big, not to mention, you know, the five or six other proposals that will be coming later this year and into next. You know, third, the transition periods really need to be thoughtfully and flexibly set. I know the FASB is intending to release an exposure draft later this year to solicit comment on transition periods, but I just can't stress enough that, you know, in order to allow companies to deploy implementation resources in the most appropriate and effective way, that drives a controlled process, which then allows the auditors to have, you know, a thoughtful audit process. And lastly, I think the regulatory environment is going to need to facilitate an orderly implementation and be prepared to deal with diversity in practice and emerging views on application and standards as they become embedded in practice. And I'll just take a couple of minutes and talk about each of these in a little bit more detail. You know, first, the standard setting process. You know, I've talked about, you know, the magnitude and volume of the changes under consideration, and it's really important that the board receives high-quality comment letters, that they continue the outreach efforts and public dialogue, and that their staff has time as they go through the process to just really thoughtfully consider not only, you know, how the standard's being written, but how it works across and you know, how it really compares and contrasts. And it's challenging under normal conditions, you know, let alone, you know, the volume that you're dealing with right now. And, you know, the current compression of time for all the steps to occur is very concerning. And it compounds as we move through the process. I mean, constituents have less time to read and understand. That could adversely affect the quality and quantity of the information obtained by the board. You know, providing appropriate comments and identifying inconsistencies is going to consume significant resources at the accounting firms as well. And the comment periods, I think, are going to be really critical. especially given the overlapping nature of them. You know, many preparers are only able to spend time deeply studying those standards that directly affect them. And in many cases, it means they're unable to evaluate the consistent application of the requirements and concepts across the standards. And it raises the possibility that important questions about consistency or scope will be overlooked. You know, and as we at GE have begun analyzing the exposure drafts, it really has become of increasing concern to me. I mean, we've had to divide and conquer to ensure that we can really deeply evaluate each of the standards. And as we go through this process, it's becoming more and more concerning that, you know, I really want our teams to go across and really compare notes about how the projects intersect. And I worry about our time to really do that in a quality way, in a way that'll give the board thoughtful, not only questions, but maybe some potential thoughts on solutions as well. But I also would imagine the board faces a similar dilemma, you know, as the volume of concurrent projects may fragment and dilute your time, or maybe your staff's time, you know, making it more and more difficult to ensure that the principles are internally consistent amongst the projects. There are just a number of significant linkages, and Larry talked about a bunch of these, but, you know, should lease assets and performance obligation liabilities, you know, do those get scoped into the financial instruments project? Are they required to be fair valued or not? You know, which principles apply there? You know, is the right to use intellectual property model in RevRec, you know, consistent with the right to use tangible property model in the leasing project? You know, there's a number of examples like this, and I could rattle off several more that just are really critically important to resolve before we actually move to implementation. And the reason I bring it up isn't to talk so much about due process, but it's really to raise the question that, you know, when you have these kinds of inconsistencies and they're undiscovered or they're not resolved in the due process time frame, it inevitably creates potentially significant interpretive issues and diversity in practice. And, you know, we've had many standards today that have had to be revised to address interpretive and operational issues that have emerged. You know, you've got FAS 96 and 109, you've got 140, 166, which, you know, was generated from 125. You could talk about FIN 46R and some others. But as you look at how we've had to evolve these over a number of years, there have been really important issues where companies have taken, you know, thoughtful and reasoned approaches and trying to do the right thing, but have ended up on two different sides of the coin in terms of how they've implemented. You know, and given that volume, I think it's going to be important for folks like the PCAOB and others to really think about what they need to be doing now to anticipate that and how they need to be involved in the FASB process to ensure that, you know, the FASB has the right feedback to determine when it just needs to slow down or take a different approach. You know, in addition to the interpretive, there's a whole host of significant operationally demanding requirements. You know, Larry talked about those, and I think the most important thing to talk about here is, do we have enough time, and, you know, how will we think about the nature of new standards, and just how will we, as a group, have the right collective approach to the accounting issues and questions. You know, these standards, as Larry mentioned, set forth broad principles, and they don't have a lot of bright lines. And they don't have, you know, significant detailed interpretive guidance. And they cover areas where we have historically had that, like RevRec and leasing. And while I think most folks fully support principles-based standard, I think the question is how concerned should we be about our collective ability to kind of shift into a mode of accepting good faith, reasonable judgments that are going to be necessary, and the judgments are going to differ across industries, companies, and potentially even audit firms. And, you know, the question is, are preparers ready to assume the responsibility for the judgments? Are the auditors ready to document and accept reasonable judgments and audit them? And are regulators willing to accept those as well? And I think there's also, and Larry alluded to this, you know, kind of natural inherent biases that carry over from existing GAAP in terms of how to apply the rules. You know, Larry talked about the historical aversion to recognizing contingent revenue. Well, that's fundamentally different in the RevRec exposure draft that's coming out. And, you know, I think that over time, that will be those types of issues will create some potentially difficult issues to resolve in practice. And Larry talked about a number of those. Operational challenges are also going to challenge closing cycles, and I think as closing cycles are challenged for companies due to things like estimating fair value for financial instruments, recording loan interest income at the effective rate under the new guidance versus at the contractual level, really looking at operating leases, I think all those things that compress a closing cycle compress the amount of time that auditors have to audit the actual underlying financial statements and to really challenge the process. You know, the transition time frame is just concerning. I think the exposure draft later this year is going to be really critical to help solicit views on that. I worry about whether we go for a big bang, whether we go for a very staged implementation, whether we allow companies to determine their own adoption paths. I know there's a natural leaning towards going for more of a big bang approach or a very set staged adoption path, but I can tell you that as you apply these standards across companies, they affect people in different ways. You know, we have a commercial leasing and lending business that if we said, you know what, let's apply financial instruments and leasing in the same time frame, you know, those changes are just very significant. They involve the same sets of technical resources at companies. They involve the same data sets that both our risk personnel and our accounting personnel use. And it's very, very difficult when you're managing a lot of change to do it all at once, right, and to do it in a controlled and thoughtful way. So I think, you know, auditors, the PCAOB preparers and others will need to be very, very thoughtful as to how they advise you and the board in terms of how to set that process. You know, Larry, you talked about it a little bit, but, you know, I think auditors, the need for a judgment framework is going to be really critical. You know, understanding how to adequately document the judgments that were made, I think that need is going to be even more pronounced. You know, as we adopt standards requiring more granular disclosures, you know, it seems to me the issue of materiality and audit scope may become more important. You know, how much auditing is really needed to determine that the financial statements taken as a whole are fairly presented, given the volume of detail that, you know, continues to be included in the footnotes. You know, I think we've added a lot of detail in the last couple of years, but these new proposals add quite a bit more, and I think that question will need to come front and center and really need to be resolved. So just taking a step back and closing, the potential changes proposed are really significant. I think drafting and finalizing so many standards with fundamental changes in a compressed time period may increase risk. The FASB, SEC, PCAOB, and others should collectively and proactively evaluate the risks that this will create. And we need to ensure we have the appropriate time to implement quality standards. We know the criteria and the mechanisms to slow down the process if we need to. We need to form working groups to interpret consistently and timely and develop an auditor judgment framework to enable decisions about acceptable alternatives and what may be a fluid implementation and post-implementation environment. So.
Great. Marty, let me echo the comments of Larry and Jamie, thanking you for giving us the opportunity to weigh in on such an important issue. It's interesting listening to the comments of Larry and Jamie, a lot of common themes, and I think you'll hear more of that in what I'm going to say over the next few minutes. I'll say at the outset that I've got the greatest respect for the FASB, the IASB, and the staffs, and they've taken on a monumental challenge in getting these convergence projects done. And so I don't believe for a second that the boards would, you know, issue standards that they believe were less than high quality. I've heard it with Larry today. I had the opportunity to hear that directly from Bob Herz over the last week. So the intentions is really not the issue. I think the boards have all the right intentions in issuing high-quality standards. The issue is more about, we talked about redoubling efforts. You can talk about redoubling efforts, re-tripling efforts. Efforts is not the problem. Okay, the boards are working incredibly hard. The staffs are working incredibly hard. The issue is, I think, capacity in the system, as Larry acknowledged and as Jamie mentioned in her comments as well. When you talk about, you know, the history, you look at the history. You know, you go back to 2001, and there were four standards issued in 2001, the previous record for the FASB. You could argue that two of those standards were really the same standard, so it's more like three. If you look at the nature of those standards, while there was some complexity there in business combinations, if you compare it to what we have today, leases, revenue recognition, financial instruments, just the qualitative aspects of the standards that are being proposed, as well as the number. So we're more than doubling the record, you know, in the time frame, in a similar time frame. And that certainly raises, you know, our concerns around the quality of those standards. Again, not that there would ever be an intention of issuing anything other than high-quality standards, but you don't know what you don't know. And without the system being able to provide input in a robust way, because there will be input. I think everybody's going to take a shot at providing input, you know, to the FASB and to the ISB. But it's the quality of that input. Do people really have the time? Do companies have the time to invest in really wrapping, you know, their best resources around these very complicated standards and providing the inputs that's necessary to really issue high-quality standards? And I would say even in the best of times, the runway here is too ambitious, but these aren't the best of times. You know, companies have reduced their staffs to manage through a tough economy and to manage costs. And while there is the capacity to deal with some level of standard setting, and there should be, and there is, you know, trying to set a record in this environment is really the wrong way to go in my mind. And I understand that, you know, even if you cut back to two or three of these, you know, in a year or a year and a half, that would be incredibly ambitious. So at the end of the day, I do understand the pressure as it relates to timing. I think Larry talked about it in his comments. You know, there's certainly political pressure in Europe to get done. Convergence is a dirty word in Europe, especially when you go beyond June 2011. For the reasons Larry stated, you do have turnover at the board level. I think the one I find more compelling is the fact that you have a number of countries that are adopting IFRS, and it would be unfortunate if they have to adopt and then have to redo all these standards again. I mean, that's very unfortunate. But at the end of the day, high-quality standards, you know, should be the primary goal, and I just fundamentally don't believe that there's sufficient time to get the input necessary to produce high-quality standards. So, you know, that's relating to the standard-setting process, and I think as companies try to comment during this period, it will be a significant distraction, bringing this back to what it means for auditors. It will be a distraction. And at the end of the day, I don't think, even with that distraction, companies will be able to provide the input necessary that the FASB and the ISB really need to produce high-quality standards. As it relates to implementation, I think because if these standards are produced in this time frame, because the time frame is so compressed, we're going to find out a lot as companies try to implement the standards that we otherwise would have found out during the standard-setting process. And so the concern I have around that is we may end up, you know, similar to in previous standards, when you implement the standards, you find out there are operational issues, you end up revising the standards, deferring the standards, and the concern there is the credibility of the standard-setting process if we end up redoing a number of the standards because of a very compressed time frame during the standard-setting process. Jamie mentioned it, and Larry mentioned it. You know, certainly there is a much greater degree of judgment that's pervasive in these new standards, financial instruments being the obvious one, the greater expansion of level three valuations, for sure will introduce more judgment. Not saying that's a bad thing. It's going to, you know, the system is going to need to adapt to that, and people will need to put in, you know, different systems, processes, controls to make sure that those judgments are made in the appropriate way within an appropriate band. Similar leasing, you know, just getting, you know, a company getting their arms around the population of leases will be an incredible challenge. And depending on whether this is retrospective or prospective in the adoption, I mean, it really is going to be a monumental task. Other matters with respect to judgment relating to leasing, and Larry mentioned it during his remarks, you know, what is the lease term, contingent rentals, so there will be more judgment there. You know, revenue recognition, you know, certainly I think it is a good thing to have the revenue guidance under one standard rather than to run around and try to, you know, hunt and peck and find it under 200 separate pieces of literature. So I think that's a positive. But certainly more judgment as companies consider contingent revenue and how that, you know, turns into revenue recognition. When you have multiple element arrangements, how do you split up that revenue? So there will be more judgment there. Again, not a bad thing, but the system will need to adapt to that. Financial statement presentation. The thing that I hear when I'm out visiting with companies is there's a lot of noise in the system, a lot of tension around the direct method of presenting cash flows and the cost that will be associated with that versus the benefits to investors. So that's getting a lot of attention. But certainly, in terms of implementation, that will require time, effort, and cost to get things in place to make that happen. So as you think about the implementation and you go beyond the accounting, these standards are just so pervasive. They will affect how a company contracts with employees, contracts with banks, you know, debt covenants, you know, how you do business with your customers. You know, if you had previously leased to your customers, your customer may have a different idea about how they want to do business going forward. So there's just a number of things that will happen that will change fundamentally so many things around how a company does business and how they do things internally, and certainly their internal controls that will need time, you know, for them to adapt, and certainly will affect, you know, the audit of these audits of these companies. And again, not that this is a bad thing, but you know, there needs to be an appropriate amount of time for the system to adapt. So in terms of what this means in terms of considerations, both to the FASB and the PCAOB, for the FASB, I similar to Jamie, commend the FASB for exposing separately the adoption and transition. I think that that'll be very instructive in terms of, you know, what people believe is doable. I would certainly think about, you know, extended adoption periods given the breadth, the complexity, and volume of the standard setting, so enough time for the system to manage that. Also, there's certainly benefits of comparability in going retrospective versus prospective. But, you know, I think that the cost needs to be weighed as well and consider prospective application to the extent that that can be done. I think that'll take some of the tension out. For the PCAOB, similar to Jamie, I think that it's critical, Marty, and I know you have a process for being connected to the FASB, and I imagine this is putting a little bit of stress on your team in managing through and commenting on so many standards in such a short period of time. But if there was ever a time that it was important to really be connected on a real-time basis with the FASB, certainly now is that time. And similar to Jamie's remarks around business judgment, you know, there's the business judgment framework that the Committee to Improve Financial Reporting released. It never turned into anything at the SEC, but I think it's generally a pretty good model as I think about making accounting judgments. And so I think that's something for preparers to think about as we move to greater and greater judgment. And I would also agree that, you know, that will certainly drive more judgment in auditing. And maybe in the longer term, we need to think about an auditor's judgment framework and what it means in terms of making judgments within a reasonable range of judgments, recognizing that just because something's judgmental doesn't mean every judgment's right. And so driving quality through a framework that auditors can use as practical guidance. So again, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Larry, Jamie, and Mike very much for your comments. I think as everybody can see from these comments that there's a tremendous challenge for financial reporting in front of us, and therefore inherently there's a tremendous challenge for auditors, which goes right to the heart of the PCAOB and our responsibilities and the input of this group, the SAG. I don't think I need to make too many more comments to open it up to the floor, but clearly we are working on these standards, and we'll be looking at all of them with respect to issues on auditability. As Larry mentioned, many of them go into a much more principles-based type approach, and in many areas, judgment is increased greatly. So we'll have to look at our existing standards and how they work vis-a-vis these new accounting standards, and also overall auditability issues that might arise from all of this, as well as the quality that can go into audits with compressed timeframes and all of that. So maybe the quality control standards have to be addressed as well at the PCAOB. But I think with let me not take up any time. I'm sure many have comments here, so let me open it up to the floor for your views on the impact of all of this on auditors, the auditing profession, and the PCAOB.
Schroeder. This is a question about to both Jamie and to Mike. You made comments about timing, cycles, and a few other things. And I'm going to tie this together with another comment that a senior partner from one of the larger firms made to me a couple months ago, that they did not feel that, he felt that maybe 10% of their audit staff was qualified to really do the assessments of fair value. So I sit here in with a quandary. I'm a strong believer, to use Larry's terms, I'm probably a zealot on the fair value side, but recognize there's a deep end and a shallow end of the pool from an investor standpoint. The shallow end of the pool is a safe cost accounting. We all kind of can agree to what we paid for something. And the deep end of the pool for the expert swimmers is more the fair value, and it's used in a different way, and it gets prepared in a different way and on a different cycle. So, Jamie, to your question about cycle, have we, in effect, moved the cycle of reporting post the end of each quarter too far up? Have we gotten too short a time frame? Alcoa came out and reported on Monday. The banks are reporting. J.P. Morgan reported today. Citi tomorrow. They're all doing it somehow. Have we gotten too short of a cycle? And would you see this standard lengthening out the cycle time? That's the first question.
I guess the question of have we moved the time frame up too far, I think that's really a question for investors and users of financial statements. You know, one of the common themes we hear in standard setting as well as in practices, we want more sooner. Right. So, I guess I'm not in a position to really opine on that. I think we try to get information to investors as timely as we can and provide it in a compliant way. You know, to your question of, how can we really ingrain this in and will this lengthen the closing cycle, I think there's no question that incorporating some of these concepts into, the guts of the ledgers and subledgers and, preparing a fair value and doing accounting at that level, at the instrument level, there's no question that that will lengthen closing cycles for some period of time. I think there's so many interpretive issues that are going to have to be thought through and actually developing what the policies and the control frameworks are to ensure that, for example, when you're determining the fair value of a loan with certain characteristics in a certain market at the loan level, that you're providing, the right framework for people to just routinely make that decision, right? You don't want to, as a company, I don't want people to have free latitude on every single item to go out and just do what they think is right, because I'll get a lot of inconsistency in that process. So we have to go through a process of really, ingraining the process down to the right level. But as we start to exercise those new muscles and really think differently about fair value versus amortized cost, I just think it's going to take a while to absorb that. And there's just no question that to get it right, you have to not only be able to account for it, but you have to analyze it. In analyzing the data, I think, for investors, for companies, for boards, and for others, I just think that's going to take a while to digest as well. I mean, it's going to be – some of the results are going to be really counterintuitive for people. You know, when you think about fair value accounting for deposits and for liabilities and incorporating credit spreads and other things, it's just – it's just going to take a while. So to me, that gets into this question of transition timelines, right, which is, how much time is appropriate to allow parallel processing and for the absorption before you actually
It seems
live.
Like in other countries, like Canada, their banking cycle is significantly after the U.S.'s. European banks are even further behind. It seems like investors could adopt if they're getting better quality information. So I think the cycles are important. Clearly recognize the issue, but may be able to expand that out. Mike, on the judgment side, clearly auditors will have to use a lot of more judgment, and they may not all be up to speed on what the issues are at this point in time. If instead of doing the single column balance sheet that is proposed by the FASB, if it were to be a side-by-side balance sheet of cost in one column and fair value in the other, would that give the auditors some degree of comfort or safety in that to say, okay, we nailed the cost side. We nailed that column. Fair value, it's an estimate, guys. Will that give you some cover over time?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think the answer is no, because I think we will be held accountable. If you do a side-by-side, there's going to be accountability for both. Not to say that an estimate of fair value is always, a single point number. There is a range of numbers that you could agree that, is a reasonable range. But, how you come up with that, how management comes up with that range and how an auditor audits that range, still has to be, notwithstanding the fact that you may have side-by-side with amortized cost, I think there will be accountability and should be accountability for auditing that fair value number as well.
I would just add one comment, and I'll yield to someone else. The you know, we're certainly held accountable every single day to be able to fair value our assets and liabilities, and our investors expect us to be able to do that, and there are a range of companies that can do it on any given day. I'm just wondering if we're not making the same argument that the banks made in the 1980s, late 80s, when they were doing risk-based capital, and they only had to divide their balance sheet into four different categories and apply a percentage to each of the four categories. And they, oh, my gosh, that's really, really hard to do. Well, today, 14,000 of those, or half of those 14,000 banks are gone, and maybe what we're saying is that maybe the companies are not sophisticated enough to actually do and exist in today's business. So just close with that one comment.
Thanks, Hal. Tom, did you want to, Linzire, did you want to respond to that dialogue, or do you have a separate point?
I have a separate point. So
all right. Well, then in order, Wayne Collins.
Probably heard the word challenge more today than in the last year or so. And recognizing that each of the standards present its own set of challenges, but that there was one common theme that I think underpinned each one of those was that on a professional judgment framework, which could be applied. Now, recognizing that this is really, number one, it's a preparer issue first because it's management's financial statement. So I see either FASB or SEC coming up with a professional judgment framework, much like CIFR had recommended, and I think a very similar framework could be done from an auditing perspective. This was discussed at length at the last IFER meeting in London with the working group. It's not the first time that it's been mentioned, but it sounds like it's really time for something like that to be seriously considered because it will be the foundation for making the judgments in each one of these standards.
Thanks, Wayne. Kevin Riley?
Marty, it's almost the same comment that Wayne's raising, and that is I can't think of a more important time now to have a judgment framework, not only for preparers, but for auditors. Because otherwise, my fear is we're going to suffer death by a thousand cuts trying to go through standard by standard in terms of what it means to the auditors when the bigger picture, I think, is quite clear. Larry articulated it well, more judgment required. Mike touched on it. Jamie touched on the need for a judgment framework. And I think there's just a crying need for, as a first step, to move in that direction first. Larry, from a preparer's perspective, you know, doing away with 200 pieces of specific guidance could leave a void, and without thinking regarding how you apply judgment in the application of a more principles-based world will lead to a lot of difficulties from a preparer's perspective. And then, Marty, I think from an auditing perspective, we need to follow right along with that in terms of bigger picture application of judgment by auditors to cover a variety of more principles-based standards.
I hear you. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just say, I mean, this strikes me as completely nuts. When you started, in your comments, Larry, you talked about three factors that it's important for FASB to consider: the independence of the process, improving the quality of U.S. accounting, and convergence. And it strikes me that really the second one of that is the only priority that matters. Independent process is very important, but it's process as a means towards an end. Convergence is only a good idea if it either promotes an improved quality of accounting in the U.S. or at least doesn't undermine it. And so we seem to be finding ourselves in a situation in which this third priority of convergence, and convergence under what strikes me as just an absolutely arbitrary time deadline, is being allowed to undermine these other two priorities. And through no fault of FASB's, I mean, you didn't create the schedule, but it seems to me that someone sort of needs to be the grown-up in the room and stands up and says, look, this has got to stop. It's not working. You can't do this fast. We haven't even really considered whether it's, you know, this adoption of IFRS, you know, isn't altogether a good idea. It's not something that was advocated by investors or users of financial statements for the most part. And so then we have this conversation. We end up saying, okay, well, we're going to go towards more principles-based standard, also something not advocated by investors or users of financial statements. They require greater judgments. So if we're going to have greater judgments, then the issuers and the auditors want this judgment framework, which gives them some degree of comfort that they're not going to be second-guessed on their judgments. Well, nobody second-guesses reasonable judgments. We second-guess unreasonable judgments, which we recognize the minute everything is blown up in our face. And I just, to me, it's like we're sitting here in this room talking about the topic that is going to be the source of the next round of huge accounting scandals, and I just think it's a mess.
Well, I think we heard that comment clearly, so... I noticed, Larry, you put your card up during Barbara's comments, so maybe you might have be responding to that.
Well, I appreciate your comments. And it is nuts in a certain sense because we as board members talk about it among ourselves all the time as to, you know, how to do the business of the FASB in this environment, okay? And there's various different pressures on us. You know, if you read the international press, you know, it's the slow laggard FASB that can't get anything done, whereas the ISB is just moving forward just nice, which I would debate that since they've only issued 9 standards in 9 years, but that's besides the point. In terms of someone needs to be the grown-up in the room, okay, that's when I put my thing up. And I just want to emphasize that, you know, we are doing our best to manage in an environment where there's conflicting pressures, okay? You know, the U.S. Treasury wants us to converge, all right? Let me finish. The SEC, I think, has been very reasonable in their comments to say that, look, we're going to look at your progress on MOU projects, but we're not making the decision based upon you issuing all standards by June 2011. Okay, I think they've been extremely reasonable. We hold a unique position in the standard-setting world by being invited to the table to deliberate with the IASB. There is no other standard setter in the world that has that position, and we're doing our best to manage that. But at the same time, and the only reason why I put this up is to reiterate that if at the end of the day we don't think that, A, we've gotten robust comments from our constituents in response to exposure drafts, and or we have not had the time to consider what those comments are. And I can speak on behalf of all board members, I believe, to say that we will not vote for a standard. At least I know I will not vote for a standard. And I appreciate the comments of Mike and Jamie in terms of the pressure that this has put on the system. And we're hearing those. We are issuing. I'm so glad you mentioned the fact that we're issuing a separate exposure draft or exposure document on transition unto itself. And we are just doing our best to operate in a world that we don't know what the future is. We don't know what the SEC is going to do, you know.
Can I just, one clarifying point. I made that comment, probably not well chosen, but I was not referring to the FASB. I
didn't take it that way.
Okay.
I didn't take it that way. All I'm trying to say is that, you know, I think we are trying to work as reasonably as we can. To the extent that you still think it's unreasonable, you know, I applaud PwC for putting out their point of view, you know, document a couple of days ago. You know, I mean, we took a crack at it. They don't think it's enough, and you know, we'll caucus and figure out how to deal with that. But it's not, you know, sometimes it's like the United Nations. It's not easy dealing in an international U.S. framework and trying to come up with something that's satisfactory to everybody. It's really kind of unique and frustrating sometimes.
Tom?
Let me build on that a little bit. The stated reasons for the deadline, and I don't view it as a deadline, but the stated reasons as a deadline is turnover at the ISB, and it's countries adopting in 2011 and 12. I don't believe either of those are credible. Okay? I believe the reason there's a 2011 target date deadline is political. And we have to understand, Larry brought up good points, we're living in a political world. And joining the conversation is a privilege. But some of the it is political. The ISB has made commitments to get things done by 2011. That is why we're on the path. Because the turnover of the board's not a legitimate reason. If you're a legitimate board, boards turn over. And they have to be able to go on. The 2011 and 12 deadline of countries adopting is not a legitimate reason now, because if you're adopting in 11 or 12, you've got to have comparative financial statements. That means you need the standards now, and they're not done, and they won't be done until next year. Neither of those are credible reasons. It's political reasons why we're under the pressure that we're under. And I appreciate the kudos of the panel about the quality of our efforts and the stated quality of the EDs and the due process, but I just want to make clear it is going to be challenged, and it is being challenged. Right now, the ISB feels they need to get insurance out by June 30th, 2011. Getting a standard done in 11 months when the ED is not out there is a pretty challenging issue. But we've raised a very significant issue that companies that are providing health insurance to their employees will be scoped into that ED. And we've not deliberated the implications of that. We've raised it, and the answer is we've got to get done by June 30th, 2011. We're going to send the ED out. So, you know, we've got... All of us ought to be very diligent in monitoring whether or not really the quality of what is being issued is there, and whether or not, with the pressures that are political, we can survive or thrive and end up having quality standards with compressed due process. If the deadlines for comment letters are in September, October, November, and we need to be done by June 30th, 2011, and it takes at least a month or two to process a standard, you do the math in terms of the time period that we're projecting for redeliberations amongst these very, very challenging, difficult topics. And so your input to us was very critical for us to stand up and say we had a stagger. It was the FASB that said, no, we've got a stagger. And we all have to monitor that because our system is different than perhaps the system where other standards are being issued in the world if we're concerned about the outcome.
Thanks, Tom. Jeanette Franzel?
As an auditor, when I hear preparers saying that, you know, the closing cycles are going to be lengthened and capacity is going to be stretched, audit risk just immediately goes up in my mind, especially when we're dealing with such complex areas like this. And we've had an interesting experience over the last year at the GAO, slightly different. We didn't have new standards. We had completely new transactions. We are the auditor of record for the Troubled Asset Relief Program as well as the FDIC. So we had brand new financial transactions never done before, that had to be run through valuation models and had to be audited. And for the FDIC, it involved loss arrangements and agreements with banks. And for the TARP, it involved, well, as you all know, all kinds of transactions with banks, auto companies, et cetera, AIG. And Treasury, it was a heroic effort on the part of the Treasury and the FDIC and the GAO. And I just when I think about capacity, and there have been comments here about capacity in the system, that's where risk is just really, really going to increase. So just listening to this and knowing what we just went through and the Treasury and the FDIC, I think that this is going to introduce a tremendous amount of risk to both the financial reporting and the auditing of these transactions, especially in these companies, especially if it's all happening at once. The capacity issue, I think, is very serious for individual companies as well as audit firms. The U.S. Treasury was able to pull top talent from across the government, throw it onto the TARP. Well, if everybody's trying to do that at once out in the system, you know, the system isn't going to be able to support that. We at GAO were able to do the same, pull a lot of talent together, and do some very specific targeted hiring. But again, if everybody's trying to do that, I don't know where the capacity is going to come from. So I think our experience just on those two audits might give some insight into the risk that might be present in all of this implementation. But secondly, where's the capacity going to come from?
Jeanette, those are very good comments, and I appreciate the analogy you're making. It's for that reason that we put this on the agenda today, because of the heightened audit risk that we saw here at the PCAOB, and therefore to start a dialogue with SAG members about, you know, assuming this timetable stays in place and all this change takes place, what do we do from a standard setting and so forth at the PCAOB to address this audit risk? So we appreciate those points, and that's exactly what we're trying to address here today.
Yeah, and let me also add that in both of those cases, the standard audit timeframes were not met. From the preparer's side and the auditor's side, we all agreed that everybody needed more time. So for the TARP, normally at the federal audit cycle is 45 days after year end. So the TARP, Treasury took an extra 30 days. And for FDIC, I think that cycle went almost 6 months after year end before FDIC could put together the financial statements and we could adequately audit them. So we also use time frames to sort of help us absorb and take care of some of these issues.
Thank you. Lynn Turner?
Perhaps we should have started this session with a prayer. Listening to the three of you, and especially Jamie, I think this is a train wreck that's going to happen. I don't think it's waiting to happen. I think it's a train wreck starting to occur right now. I think the FASB would be well advised to turn around and drop the deadline, period. The reasons that Tom laid out are not good reasons, and yet I know that Larry is absolutely right with respect to Treasury and the politics of Treasury, but someone has to be the parent here and stand up and say, we're just not going there. And the problem about this whole conversation is there's none of it that's got back to the main objective here, and that is this whole thing will only work if at the end of the day we end up with accurate financial statements with the necessary information in them going to investors so that they can make the right decisions. If we end up with all of this at the end of the day with financial statements that don't do that, either because the standards don't get us the right information or the auditors, for whatever reason, don't do a quality audit, it won't matter what intentions are, Larry. You can have the best of intentions and be well-meaning, but if the reality diverts from that, and we end up with problems in these financial statements, no one's going to care what people's intentions are. No one's going to care about anything other than the outcome, because we're going to have a lot of people losing money. And the fact that Canada or someone else is going to IFRS shouldn't matter. The fact, the reality is, half of the capital market capitalization is in this country. And we shouldn't be having to tell the dog where to go. And yet that's exactly what's happening here. And you listen to this conversation, and Barb is right. It is absolutely nuts. anyone in their right mind. You could take a six-year-old and put them in this room and have them listen to this conversation, and they'd be looking for, where's the adult? It is absolutely simply unbelievable. And when we talk about, well, we're slowing it down to just four major standards per quarter, we haven't been doing four major standards per year. There is no way for people to provide meaningful comment. There is no way for these standards to be adequately tested to see if they're doing right. And quite frankly, the SEC needs to stand up and be the parent here and tell Treasury and others, back off and give FASB the flexibility to go do the job they need to go do. And unfortunately, I don't get the sense that this commission, as it has in the past, has stood up and played the role of the parent. And they need to do it, and they need to do it now. And we need to make sure these are good standards, that they get tested, and that Jamie and others then have the chance to put the systems in place, once they're tested, to turn around and implement them. And God bless the FASB, because they're taking on some great standards. We've all known leases have been broken for, you know, almost four decades now. One might ask, why now? What's the rush? You know? But they do need to be done. And, you know, some of this stuff is going to be different. My sense is the FASB is trying to get to the true economics, which will get us better information. Some of the fair valuation stuff, as Hal and all said. But it needs to be tested to see if it will work. And the fact that someone says, well, there's more judgment, that's, who, you know, there's a lot of judgment now. I don't know if there's going to be any more judgment than what we already have. Everyone's supposedly already auditing those footnotes with all the fair value in them, including all the big four. There may be some question about that. But so it's not supposedly all that much new. But yet we need to make sure that it turns around and works. And if we need a judgment framework, provided it's not a framework for trying to create a safe harbor or limit litigation if people make poor decisions, then so be it. We need to take the time to go through that process, and certainly should be doing it both from an auditor and a preparer perspective, as some people have said. But what we can have it is a safe harbor or something that turns around and says bad judgments get excluded out, because quite frankly, investors get no break from bad judgments. And so we need to make sure that that whole system works. And I think that's going to take some time, and that no one's actually picked up a pen and really start to develop that standard yet for either a Jamie, who's going to have to go through this process and wants to make sure she's gone through a reasonable process, or for Mike, who's also going to be held accountable. And the fact we haven't even picked that pen up and started writing it tells us this deadline is for absolutely all the wrong reasons, including politics. And when people start telling me the reason we're doing this accounting is for politics, the one thing I know, and I can guarantee it, is we're going to have a bad answer, we're going to have a train wreck, and everyone in this room knows it, and we'll have no one to look at but the person in the mirror, because no one stood up as a parent and said, time out here. And someone certainly needs to do that, and I think the SEC needs to turn around and play that role. As far as bringing it back to the auditing, then I think you've got to do some auditing standards here around the judgment stuff. The current standard we have is good, but it doesn't go far enough. And quite frankly, where we've had our discrepancies and problems in judgments is there wasn't the type of guidance that says, okay, as a preparer, you got to document it. You got to lay out your assumptions, and then here's what we expect the auditor to do that. That all needs to get laid out. And that first piece with the preparer, quite frankly, there's a question about whether that should be SEC or FASB. Someone needs to make that decision and then go into rulemaking and get that on place so that the auditors know where they need to go to get that. But that whole piece of it, no one's even picked up a pen. So how can we say we got a deadline in 2011? So, Larry and Tom, I'd urge you to take that time frame, get rid of it. People are always going to perceive that this thing blows up. that you guys put the artificial time frame in place, and ultimately you guys did do it. You had the ability to say no. The SEC had the ability to say no. And if you leave it in place, there will be no excuses, because ultimately it was you that decided and you decided to issue the standards. And there'll be no excuses at that point in time. And unfortunately, if this blows up on investors, given the amount of money that we're talking about, you know, it will be difficult to say, why should we keep the organization around? That's all I got to say.
Lynn, I appreciate you turned the comment around toward the end of that as to the implication on auditors and our need to address the standards and judgment framework. I just have to remind everybody here that I promised Larry when inviting him to this session that we wanted to talk at the SAG about the audit implications. Let's accept for the time frame that this is a timetable that's going to take place, and if it does, or if it does, what we all as audit overseers, what we have to be doing in terms of addressing audit risk, and what we have to do in terms of addressing audit standards. And I promised Larry that this session was not going to turn into a debate as to the standards themselves.
But Lynn didn't address the standards. He's addressing the process and the timing, et cetera. And you know, maybe you don't want to delve into it, but I welcome those comments because, you know, we need feedback. And we've had a lot of discussions within the organization, including ourselves, our trustees, the SEC, et cetera. And, in fact, we had meetings prior to this June 2nd press release in terms of the staging. But to the extent that and I understand what you're saying, Lynn, okay? I do understand. And at the end of the day, you're correct. We're the ones that vote for these standards, so therefore the responsibility is with us. So I appreciate those comments.
And I would tell Mari, I don't accept that deadline. And I think anyone that accepts that deadline is a fool and setting themselves up for a big problem.
Lynn, our board has never accepted the deadline. There's only been one board that's ever used the word deadline. For us, it's always been a target in a process. And I assure you, we take that to heart, and we will not accept a deadline if it leads to poor results. But I want to go back to Marty's point. I think despite all this, even if we didn't have all of this, this topic today is very important. Whether we're coming out with multiple standards at a time or not, our comment letter process is one that does not involve auditing implications. And we do not get audit input in the process, even from the audit firms. It's mostly technical accounting stuff. And so it's useful to begin to think about how the two organizations can interrelate, and if you're going to establish and implement good, high-quality standards, how the auditing issues can surface in the process, not an after fact. We get done, we finalize, then the PCAOB considers. It would be far better for us to be able to find a way to think about that together. And it might not be standard by standard. And judgments aren't just arising in the reporting model with these new standards. I assure you there's a lot of judgments already. And some of them have been called into question over time. So thinking about how we can do better between the two organizations is a very, very good thing. And so just maybe we don't have to be in the bitch fest of the current process and think together as to how to make that work.
That's extremely important, that point, that we as audit standard setters and assessing audit risk are intimately involved in this process, and that's why we're having this session today. Charlie Niemeyer, I saw you put your card up during that.
Yeah, just very quickly, Tom, just wanted to just acknowledge that your invitation and comments about considering the auditability of the accounting standards. Some of us have been concerned about that for some time, and I really appreciate your interest in that regard, and we will certainly take you up on that. Thank you.
Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I wanted to actually address the second topic on your slide there a little bit, the PCAOB guidance and getting back to what the auditors need to do. To get there, though, I mean, I could pile on to all the conversation that's gone on this morning already. As I think of it, there's four or five things that will really change audit risk. One is you've got the the need to understand a new standard, just the capacity to understand them. Secondly, building the competency, exercise judgment, that's clearly there. You've also got one that I don't think we've talked about much this morning is the process changes or the systems changes that will have to occur within an organization. If you think about something even as simple, which technically from an accounting perspective is not that technical, which is a financial statement presentation, the system and process implications of that are pretty severe. I know when we've looked at that, that's a very difficult one to implement. The direct cash flow method will take major impact on our systems and processes in the company. You go to lease accounting, financial instruments, you'll have a lot of that. So that pressure is there also. And then you compound it with, I think it was something Mike mentioned, which is this economic environment didn't leave a lot of issuers, like my company, with a lot of extra people sitting around with nothing to do. We've already been stretched. So given that those are there, which is how I would look at it as an auditor, those risks and issues are there, what does that mean? Well, that means in the short term, which is now, is we're trying to get ready, and let's just assume that we expect some new pronouncements to come out in 2011 or 2012. We have to start dealing today with how to do that. What does that mean to an issuer? We have to pull resources off the normal accounting and normal work we're doing and put them on teams and task forces to try to change and get ready for this new issuance. That raises the risk of an error or possibly even irregularity in our accounting today. When we go forward and this does get implemented in the future, again, we now have new things, new judgments, new processes. Is it perfect day one? Unlikely. It's never happened that way in the past. So we have an increase in errors and, again, the possibility of irregularities in the future. So I look at this and say audit risk is up a lot. It's up starting today, not 2011, not 2012. The audit risk is up now as we have to divert resources to get ready for this because we can't wait. We have to start thinking about it now. So what do we need as far as PCAOB guidance and updates? I'm not sure if we need a lot of new standards, maybe tweaking, changing the standards. I think there's been good discussion about judgment framework and trying to make sure there's good standards around judgment and especially documentation of maybe some of those judgments because I'm not sure the documentation standard is real clear on that. But clearly I think we need interpretive guidance to make sure the auditors understand the nature of the change in the audit risk in this environment. And I think the standards are pretty clear that audit risk always has to drive the procedures of an auditor. But I'm not so sure that we couldn't use some more interpretive guidance, whether it's a staff alert or something, that would make sure we have the right focus and right appreciation for what I'm perceiving as a substantive change in the audit risk within each of the organizations. And then, again, that would also feed back into the inspections group, so that they're looking at this properly and appropriately with ultimately good feedback into the FASB and the SEC as to how this is all working out. So I see a pretty strong need for some action by the PCAOB in that second bullet point quite soon because I think the audit risk has changed now already just with this discussion because we don't know how it's going to work out. And I can tell you as my company is an issuer, we can't wait for this to be sorted out 18 months from now as whether we have new standard. Because it takes more effort and more time than that to be ready for it.
I think those are really insightful comments about the audit risk environment today. And I think it builds on something Mike Gallagher said in his comments earlier, that companies are already stretched in the current economic environment and have reduced their resources in many cases. And at the same point in time, we'll have to be addressing how to implement these new standards. And then ultimately putting in new systems and controls around so many changes, which will obviously, we haven't talked a lot about this, but audits of internal controls over financial reporting and addressing all of those changes as well as the accounting and the financial reporting implications, the ICFR implications of the massive amount of systems changes I think you're getting at as well. So good points there. Kurt Schack.
Thank you. I think that Lynn Turner and I should do a rap on YouTube. And we can call it Convergence. What is it good for? I'm not sure that I share his view that we need spiritual help at this point, because as we read the latest SEC discussion about this and also what Larry just said about it, that the deadline is really a deadline to assess the progress. of where we are on the memorandum of understanding as opposed to making a decision about adoption. And that's the discussions that we've been hearing and having about it. But just on the capacity side, it's clearly a capacity for the issuer, preparer, auditor side. I'm not sure it's a capacity issue for the investor being unable to, you know, utilize and assess higher quality, better financial reporting. I'm not sure that's a reason for us not to be doing this. But the question I do have just on the audit side is how do you possibly get your hands around what the cost to the system is if, with this package? How do you go about doing that?
Who's that a question to?
You know, just the
I don't have a clue. I mean, it just goes beyond the scope of, you know, just I've heard estimates just on the direct method cash flow, you know, companies that have widely disparate operations, larger companies, I've heard some pretty big numbers, just that. But clearly there'll be massive changes required to systems, processes, you know, and how you go about your business. So the cost, I wouldn't hazard a guess. I would defer to some of the preparers in the room that might have a better idea than I do, but it's extensive, obviously.
Damon Silvers.
I want to make a couple of broad comments about this matter. I've always been a little bit more moderate than some investor advocates around the question of whether convergence abstractly is a good idea. I've always been open to that as a possibility. However, I have two reactions to this presentation that seems to me raise two really important points. And one of them, I think, is very much along the lines of what Lynn and Kurt and Barb have said, and that is that. I'm going to take it to a place that I'm not necessarily sure they will agree with. I'm very pleased that the PCAOB staff recognize that when you move as both the convergence agenda appears to be seeking to move and as the FASB and the ISB have been moving, when you move under the to a more comprehensive fair value approach to financial reporting, in a world in which there actually aren't markets for many things, liquid functioning markets, that you're doing the opposite of what you think you're doing. That you're moving not toward a world of greater precision and economic accuracy, but toward a world of essentially increasingly arbitrary judgments, and then that's very, very difficult to audit. Now we're seeing that sort of being shall we say, elaborated upon. And I think it's very good that the board understands that and is trying to get their arms around it. There's no way then this is not a matter the board controls, right? And this sort of goes to the point of where are the grown-ups. And I'll just restate my view that I think this notion that we are doing something useful in any respect by moving toward a universal fair value approach to financial reporting is mistaken and has had very negative economic consequences and will continue to. The second point I want to make is about the politics of this. And by the way, let me just put my one sort of caveat on that. I'm not saying that fair value is inappropriate for everything. I think there are a number of areas where it is appropriate, and the more that you are looking at assets or liabilities, think about this from the asset side. The more you are looking at assets for which there is a liquid market held against liabilities, which can be called at any time, the more that fair value is appropriate. And that leads me to my comment about the politics. I must say it's been a busy time, and I hadn't noted that the Obama administration's Treasury Department appears to be continuing on the Bush administration's Treasury Department agenda in this area. It saddens me to learn that, and I would reiterate the comments made by others that this is an area where the Commission needs to get its back up. It is not clear to me at all exactly where the political support for the Treasury Department's point of view is in our broader national government, and I can easily imagine where the opposition would come from should that agenda continue to move in that way. It finally appears to me, and this is connected to this, to my point about where the opposition would come from, it appears to me in looking through this document and from what I am aware of in terms of the general direction of both standard-setting bodies, that there's a very raw and ugly politics underneath this that hasn't been mentioned, which is that the privileged get to shape a fake fair value agenda and that the underprivileged get to live with the full negative consequences of fair value. And by that I mean it seems pretty clear that no one really intends to force large financial institutions to accurately value assets on their books which are being held against deposits on call. And that, by contrast, there is a very clear intent to enforce a fair value regime in the employee benefits context, where the liabilities are not immediate in that way, and where there's far less merit behind the whole concept. If anyone doubts what I mean, they might take a look once again, as I've said at every PCAOB SAG meeting, and as I will say until this changes. That the TARP oversight panel found that it was impossible to figure out what the value of toxic assets was on the balance sheets of the major banks. And as far as I know, it remains impossible to do that. And until that changes, it strikes me it's fundamentally unfair and politically not viable to insist that type of regime be applied to pension benefits or health care benefits. And I think that, if we want to talk politics, that is a message that will find many sympathetic ears in the Congress of the United States.
Thanks, Damon. Arch?
Thanks, Marty. I guess a few comments with respect to some of the auditing side of things. When you look at these standards and the direction that they're taking the financial reporting, it's obviously, as it's been mentioned, increasing the use of estimates, and as a result, I would suggest the lack of precision, because you are getting into some significant estimation processes. And as been mentioned, that's going to take resources to understand how to accomplish that, to change systems, to change controls. From the auditing perspective, it seems to me it's going to demand the increased use of specialists. I look at the lease accounting side, and it almost seems like it's an economic forecasting kind of model, so you may be considering the need to get economists involved. So obviously a lot of audit challenges, and I think the other thing that comes to mind from a auditing perspective is that when you get into estimation, it seems to me disclosures are going to become increasingly important. So I think you may need to look at that area from an auditing perspective and whether you feel additional requirements might be needed. I can't avoid, I guess, speaking somewhat to the standards themselves and the timing that we've talked about, and understanding that the FASB has no deadline for the issue of these standards, and their goal is improving financial reporting. But when you look at this, I think that the regulators, including the PCAOB and the SEC, do in fact have to take a look at the situation with the plans that are coming down, and if they believe that investors are going to be put at risk because of the dangers to the financial reporting or the quality of auditing, they have to stand up and speak and say this just can't be.
Thanks. Jim Schneider.
Thanks, Marty. Just a couple of observations, and again, back to the standard setting aspects of this. First one is, I agree with the comments earlier about the one of the key areas that may need some standard setting would be in the judgment area. While I acknowledge Tom's point around we make a lot of judgments today, but we're going to become responsible for making a lot more judgments, and those judgments will be a lot more important. I think in the absence of that, if you look at individual standards, what becomes a de facto standard setting process is the inspection process. And I think in connection with that, it would be very important, and I would urge the board to consider to put in a process around the inspection process that looks at those areas where there tend to be disagreements between the auditors and the inspectors around whether or not reasonable judgments were made. Because without that, as I said, the inspection findings become de facto standard setting with respect to individual standards. The last point I would like to make is in terms of the cooperation between the PCOB and the FASB, I think as a general practice, the IASB has interaction with the IAASB around their standard setting, and they actually have, in most cases, working groups set up for each proposed accounting standard project. And I think that brings a little bit more focus to each of those projects and what the auditing implications might be, and then whether the IAASB needs to take, some standard setting action in regards to those.
That's a good comment, and I think we've heard a couple of times the importance of our standard setting group to be working closely with the FASB through this, and that's come through loud and clear. Thanks. House Schroeder?
Yeah, picking up on something Lynn said earlier about, we're heading towards standards that are going to be complete chaos. I would challenge that comment because from an investor perspective, book value, current GAAP accounting, financial statements are relatively useless. I kind of think of them as a Maginot line that's constantly overrun by economic forces. I pick on J.P. Morgan because they reported today. We've seen it trade between 0.9 of book value, GAAP book value, to 2.5 times book value. And sometimes, and just in the last week, it's moved 10% against book value. It's not providing a lot of concrete information to investors, at least some investors. I do not want to speak for everyone. But I'm also very sensitive, having been an auditor for 13 years, I'm very sensitive to the comments around the room about things, pick up on a couple of comments, lack of precision, greater use of specialists, world of arbitrage judgments. All those are true comments. And as I sit here, I'm going to try to split the baby and ask a combination of the FASB and the PCAOB if it's not practical to maybe put the brakes on in some way but move us forward. We're never going to move forward if we don't force this issue of providing investors with more meaningful information. And I think we can all accept that we're not getting meaningful information today, at least not to the degree that we need it. So here's my question, proposal, thought, as I sit here and listen to everyone. If the FASB were to come and say, we're going to just freeze accounting standards as they stand today, and that we're going to present a balance sheet income statement under current accounting standards, and to the right of that, we're going to give you what we think is the right new direction for accounting standards. My personal belief, full fair value, Larry, including core deposit intangibles, and we can debate that later. Everything fair valued. I fully recognize the difficulties for some assets. I will challenge Damon on the comment that toxic assets don't have value. They may be zero, but people don't accept that. And we can debate whether toxic assets have value or not. But here's the real question. Can you present a side-by-side set of financial statements for, say, a period of 3, 4, or 5 years and just label them as unaudited, giving everyone time to build systems, build the expertise, but at the same time move the ball down the field, head us in the right direction, or what I perceive to be the right direction. And if in that process of the next 3 to 5 years we learn that, maybe it is a combination of cost and fair value, or maybe we should have one column for cost and one column for fair value, and as we learn and gain the expertise and then ultimately move toward auditing whatever it is right. And I go back to my swimming pool analogy. I'm not teaching my daughter to swim in the deep end. I'm teaching her, and she's 2 and a half. She thinks she can swim in the deep end, but I'm teaching her on the steps in the pool where she can stand up. And if we gradually move her into the deep end, she'll be okay. But it seems like we're trying to jump too quick into the deep end here, and maybe there's some interim step that we can have in an unaudited set of financials side by side.
Thanks, Hal. Gail Hansen?
One of the things that I think it would be helpful as we talk about how this impacts auditors is to think of the audit committee members, because a lot of them were educated before these standards started to come out in such rapidity, these standard changes. And so as I think about audit committees, I would like the auditors to think about the audit communications and the increased risk, because I've heard people talk about the impact of these changes in the accounting standards on the organization, the impact on audit risk, and the resources that organizations are going to need to address that. And I would encourage the auditors to put that, and I don't know if this is the PCAOB's role or not, but to put that in audit communications, because we're looking to the audit committee members to be directing the audit and be our watchdogs, and if they don't they don't talk about this on a daily basis like a lot of you that are practitioners or issuers. And so the audit committee members really have to be part of this dialogue to understand the impact that this is going to have on their organizations.
Thanks, Gail. Larry Salva.
Thanks, Marty. Doug Anderson covered a lot of what I wanted to say, but I thought that unless and until the so-called grown-up arrives in the room and calls an end to the insanity of trying to make believe that we're going to stay on this treadmill on this time frame, whether you call it a deadline or a target, I think a lot of us believe that even the target is just not achievable. So, and like I said, unless and until the insanity ends, I think the responsible thing to do is for, and I think it's a combination of the SEC and the PCAOB, is to set priorities in terms of what if certain amount of change is implemented fairly quickly, whether it's 3 standards, 5 standards, or even just 1 standard. But we know that even if it comes later, we're moving from a rules-based environment, and most of the profession, the generation of the profession that's there today, whether it be preparers or auditors, have been working mostly with rules. I believe the biggest priority is for the accounting judgment framework to actually get documented, developed and adopted, and respected if followed. The auditing judgment framework, I think, is important that it get the same thing happen, that it be developed and adopted and respected if followed by the regulators, by the inspectors, et cetera. That auditing judgments and estimates standard could and should be improved. And as Lynn mentioned, somehow it seems like the preparation of fair value in footnotes is not as diligent either by the preparer or by the auditor somehow when it's in footnotes. So more guidance on auditing footnotes and judgments and estimates in footnotes as to what's expected there. And also, as you mentioned, the internal control over financial reporting, potential guidance to auditors on assessing issuers' capacity and process for implementing accounting changes in what's reasonable. For example, when does it rise to a level of becoming a significant deficiency or material weakness in terms of a company's system of controls? I recall that as we first moved into ICR, internal control over financial reporting, that a number of companies got deficiencies identified in terms of their ability to apply FAS 109 or income tax lists because they just didn't have the right capacity in tax departments. And somehow the tax departments had been given that responsibility for the accrual accuracy. it's a, you know, it's it, the process change in terms of it's kind of both the process over the transactions that may have to change, but it's just trying to implement standard changing or a standards change. I think guidance, I just expect that we should see and should expect to see more significant deficiencies because of lack of capacity to implement change. But I think the priorities really have to be towards the judgment frameworks, because I don't believe that a lot of the people in the profession of either preparing or auditing know how to reasonably apply judgment in the application of accounting and auditing those accounting judgments.
Good comments. Thanks, Larry. Lynn Turner.
I'd like to come back to something that Jim Snur was talking about, which I think is an excellent idea, and that is the process is running, that the FASB and the PCAOB set up individual groups of staff on both sides, including someone from the international side. I'd actually bring into that someone from the preparer side as well, and so that you identify in a fashion that you identify each of the major key areas where there's potential for problem. And I think Larry did a very good job of teeing up some of those, like the contingent rent type area, but there's other areas. This thing changes dramatically, accounting for derivatives and especially in the area of hedging, and there's some real serious problems potentially there. So I would urge you to put together groups on, and I first identify each of those areas, then assign a group to each of those. Someone from the SEC should be on that group as well. And figure out exactly how this thing's going to work and how you think you can reasonably audit it before you ever see the FASB adopt a final standard, so that we know the thing can work before we put it out there and can be implemented by companies in a reasonable fashion. Because as we found from time to time, we've written standards that we think are very good, but you just can't implement them. And it doesn't matter how good the standard is, if we can't implement it and get to good numbers, then again, it isn't going to get us the results that we're looking for. And because these changes are so huge in terms of today's companies and financial statements, and there's so many of them coming, I think it's imperative that, and you know, it's consistent with what the O'Malley panel recommended in 2000, that you set up those groups now, go through that process, such that by the time the board comes out with the standard, you're reasonably comfortable, preparers are reasonably comfortable, this shouldn't be used just as a vehicle to slow down the process, because if that's the way it was used, it'd be extremely unfortunate. But if it's used to really ensure we get better standards and everyone's on board with it, so everyone's buying in before we get to the end, and ultimately it is the FASB's decision here, not the other groups, but ultimately I think that will end up with a lot better standards and process. I would also go back to something that Kurt said about investor education. I don't think investors are even remotely prepared to handle this right now. I've dealt with some of the biggest banking analysts who, surprisingly to me, have indicated they're going to have a very extreme time figuring out how to put fair values into their models. I'm shocked by that. I'm a big proponent of fair value. I personally think it should be a flat two-column approach, one column fair value and one column historical cost. But nonetheless, what I am hearing from investors, and I'm sure it'll be the same thing on issues like contingent rent, for those investors who actually read the financial statements and use them, I think there's going to be a big change in their models as well. There can't help but be a change in their models, and they're going to have to get educated as well. And we're going to have to see how that process will work, because if investors don't know how to handle the information and what the accounting is yielding to them, then we'll have some quagmire there as well. And there's been some indication that they, in some places just want to maintain the status quo, so they don't have to go through that education process or change their model. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. And I think people have to consider that there's going to have to be quite an education process on the investor side of this thing as well.
I guess as you're talking about implementation, you're also talking as well, Lynn, about it's one thing for preparers to implement. It's also another thing for the auditors to the auditability of that implementation, which can be even if preparers are implementing something using a lot of judgment, how are the auditors auditing that and the auditability of that? So that's the issue we keep seeing to be hearing today.
Yeah, one it's interesting, especially when I heard Mike's conversation at the beginning of this thing. You know, the auditors, and people have heard about this, you know, a decade and a half ago, told the FASB, if you write the standard, we can audit it, no problem. You know, I'm not sure that's necessarily true, even though they said it. To some, you know, to a large extent, this is being driven. What we're seeing happen now is what the large accounting firms all ask for. You know, it's like you asked for it, you got it. You know, I think that was Toyota who said that. But we might be having the same result. But the firms did ask for this principle-based approach, and they asked for it quickly. The FASB is now giving them exactly what they're asking for, and now all of a sudden you hear them all saying, whoa, wait a minute here. And I think, you know, that just there's just something wrong about that. And so I think the firms need to get behind the FASB and work with the FASB and figure out how to make this thing work, because I think in areas like fair value, the FASB is working in the right direction. Some of the other things, I don't agree with them, but the FASB's given them what they asked for, and they now owe it to the FASB to figure out how to make it work.
Thanks. Sure.
If you go back to my comments, we did talk about, you know, the change in judgment, and a number of times I said that's fine and that's a good thing, but it's the time frame that we're talking about, and I worry about the input that the FASB is going to get during this time frame. We are for quality standards, and judgment's fine, but let's do it in a way where we're not undoing it when we do the implementation.
Brian Croteau, have your card up?
Yeah, thanks, Marty. I just wanted to quickly pick up on 2 points. One with respect to internal control over financial reporting, and certainly there are rules and requirements and models in place today in terms of thinking about design and implementation of controls and auditors auditing controls. Now, you know, what could be supplemented in terms of bringing the right attention on controls in a rapidly changing environment, I think is a question that is ripe for consideration given the topics that have been discussed today. Would certainly be interested in understanding, though, is that something additive to current rules and requirements versus, again, bringing attention to how to apply what you currently have in place as a question. And then with respect to the judgment framework, certainly the CIFER report did have a list of 11 factors and some documentation considerations, which you know, seemed fairly reasonable, at least in my own view, and wondered, you know, there's nothing really that would prevent, obviously, companies and auditors from looking to that today, and I suspect some do. So the comments with respect to taking some particular action, wonder whether there's, you know, any particular advice as to whether there's something that needs to be done incrementally to those type suggestions, or whether it's just, again, trying to formalize and make that better known.
Thanks. There are two cards up, Jeanette Frenzel and Damon Silver. There's three cards up. So in that order, why don't we take those three comments from the three of you, and then we're running over and we'll break for lunch. Jeanette?
In thinking about the PCAOB's role here, I would urge you to really take a look at this whole situation really as a systemic risk issue. What is what are the risks associated with maintaining high audit quality and confidence given all of this? And what can the PCAOB do to help mitigate those risks from the standpoint of issuing standards, implementation guidance, working with the profession, et cetera? You know, regardless of how we end up with convergence and when we get there, there is going to be risk, and I think PCAOB can and should play a key role in helping to mitigate that risk, because I think that otherwise the system just won't have the capacity. So to the extent that you all can mitigate that, I think that's a very important role. Also, keeping in mind that whatever risks don't get mitigated by the preparer community tend to get tossed over to the audit community, I think also it would be very prudent for you all to work very closely with SEC and FASB to really ascertain which risks can be mitigated on that side to help reduce the systemic risk that you all are facing. So I would just really urge you to look at this problem from that standpoint.
Thanks, Jeanette. Damon?
I just wanted to briefly clarify, because I think maybe Harold misunderstood something I said, but it has a larger relevance. I've spoken this many times at this body. My view is not that toxic assets have no value. My view is that whatever the value is of the toxic assets that are on bank balance sheets right now, it is not possible to discover it by looking at the firm's financial statements. And I think that's a big problem. That was the conclusion of our oversight panel when we looked at this a year ago. I don't think anything has particularly changed. I don't doubt that there is a value associated with those assets. I don't know what it is. Some of those assets may have a value of zero, as Harold suggested. Others may, in fact, no longer be toxic. It's just that you can't tell, and that's a big problem. Secondly, it seems to me this discussion draws out something that, in a way, it shouldn't be necessary to say. I think those who look for financial statements to essentially track stock prices, right, I misunderstand what a financial statement is. The financial statement is an input into what investors and transactors and capital markets do, but it by definition can't move with the markets. And the attempt to make it do so, you end up because the actual life of a business cannot be decomposed from the movements of stock prices, the effort to do so turns the financial statement into something not usable. It turns it into mush. And I think you can see that process unfolding in the presentation we've heard this morning, as the effort to try to establish a simultaneity and a precision that doesn't exist in the real world ends up requiring both preparers and auditors to essentially make increasingly arbitrary decisions. Then, as I said before, in the service of attempting to get greater precision and market relevance, you end up with less.
I'm not suggesting there's 100% correlation between the markets and accounting, but there has to be some relationship, and today that relationship has been tremendously broken.
Neary Buxman?
Thank you, Marty. I think the last observation actually ties up to what I wanted to start with. I think people need to recall what's the purpose of financial statements, and it's to aid in decision making. And the debate about fair value or historical cost crystallizes the fact that, you know, many intelligent individuals are thinking about it for a long duration and still didn't reach a universal conclusion what's better. Sometimes it states that either different people have different objectives, and sincerely so, or a different situation giving rise to different results, even for the same instruments or the same class of assets. Which gets me to another point where we're thinking about it in the context of financial statements. I think we need to highlight disclosures, because both financial statements and disclosures provide investors and users with the tools they need to do exactly what both Hal also echoes here around the table. A few things that haven't been discussed here today, and I think there has been a concept of kind of pencils down. And I think some of the challenges that we are observing now is the lack of conceptual framework to reconcile with. because transitioning boards in theory should not affect the principal thought if you have, you know, if you have a good conceptual framework. It's almost, if the law of the land exists, it's very easy to write bylaws. It's very difficult to write bylaws when you don't have a law of the land and try to reconcile as an inconsistent framework. It gives you an answer that different boards could have vastly different opinions of how things should be presented, given the fact that different people could have, as we've seen here around the table today, different views about presentation. So there's some merits or scope to, if we do put some hands on some breaks here, we need to think about more comprehensively what financial statement represents, what they are, including the context of audits. And this takes me to, if we do that, I'd like to point to another element, which is a disclosure framework. This had been proposed by the ITAC, and I think there could be some merits that if you don't figure out the accounting yet, there's some scope to tell me the story in the footnotes. And clearly it's going to be audited somehow, which takes me to the last topic that I wanted to touch on is judgment framework and the judgment we discussed. And maybe I'm a bit naive, but I think two things immediately come to mind. One is that the two types of judgment where I think some seems to kind of being intertwined in our discussion. One is the preparer judgment, and two is the auditor judgment. I always felt the financial statements are in the business of judgment to begin with from preparer. Whether, and it starts with the simple issue of depreciating assets over its useful life. Quite a complex undertaking if you think about it. Very complex. What's the useful life of a building? Could be quite complex. Even more complex than valuing a toxic asset. And it has been done. Judgment had been applied. And it has been audited, as is purchase price allocation, as is held for sale. So it strikes me that one undertaking for the board or the boards, as well as some preparers, would be, again, I'm kind of taken back. I said, if judgments are an issue, how come they haven't been issued 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when they have been core tenets of financial reporting to begin with? So even if it's just simply reassuring, reaffirming, or clarifying, I think, could be a very useful exercise. And in my mind, it should be unrelated to any state of progress of the ISB or the FASB around the project, because it seems to be a great state of confusion around an area that, at least to me, seems to be or should be quite clear, unless I miss something.
Good. Neary, thanks for those comments. Obviously, some of the passion around this discussion today, I think, makes clear the importance of this topic, the importance of the accounting developments that are taking place, the pace and the volume of those developments, the impact of those on reliable financial reporting, the impact of those on high-quality auditing, and the impact on things that we at the PCAOB have to take into account as we work closely with and monitor this with FASB going forward. I want to thank Larry Smith very much for your comments, your presentation. Jamie and Mike, I want to thank you for your willingness to participate on the panel, and I want to thank all of the SAG members for very valuable input to us as to how we think about this going forward. We're breaking for lunch. Bella, where are we headed?
We're actually headed to the room right behind where the breakfast buffet is for the SAG members and observers. If you go out any of the doors, Lucia and Keisha will direct you to lunch. And I know we're slightly behind schedule. We have several other topics after lunch, so I was hoping if you could be back here at 1:15, that would be fantastic. Thank you so much.